Welcome to the Baptist Joint Committee podcast. I'm Jordan Edwards, Communications Associate at the BJC. On November 10th, the Baptist Joint Committee co-sponsored a symposium on religious liberty in the Black Church with Howard University School of Divinity and School of Law. The keynote speaker of the symposium was the Reverend Dr. Raphael Warnock, who is pastor at historic Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, Georgia, the spiritual home of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And here to talk with me about the symposium is the person who organized the event, Charles Watson Jr., the BJC's education and outreach specialist. Charles, how you doing?
Doing fine, Jordan.
This is the second year we've done a lecture in the fall with a social justice lean to it. Last year, we went to Fuller Seminary in Pasadena, California, where we had a pair of lectures from Judge Wendell Griffin. So, Charles, tell me about this event. How did it come together, and why did you want to have the BJC and Howard partner for this?
The first idea of having this type of lecture titled Religious Liberty in the Black Church came from actually last year's RLC luncheon where Dr. Marvin McMichael was our speaker, and where he talked about how religious liberty kind of has been a luxury to African Americans who have been fighting for other liberties and civil rights during their time here in America. So it made me start thinking about, okay, there's something different that's coming from a segment of our citizenship that we should explore, and how much of that difference can be related to religious liberty. And that kind of gave me the idea of, you know, we have a fall lecture series or symposium that we can actually dive into more of what Dr. McMichael was speaking of, and my relationship with Howard University Div School and Dean Pollard over there made it an attractive place for us to go.
Yeah, so why did you choose Howard? You specifically wanted to expand the BJC's reach into HBCUs, correct?
Not only HBCUs, but also Howard was special because it has a divinity school and a law school. And just a couple of years ago, those two schools actually combined on the same campus. So it was just a perfect setting for us.
The symposium had two parts to it. We had Dr. Warnock's lecture that we had inside the moot courtroom, and then we had a lunch and learn panel. Can you tell the people who are listening a little bit about the panel and who was on it and what it was about?
We had the panel after the lecture, and the great thing about a panel is you get so many voices to be a part of it. Dr. Warnock did a great job during the lecture, and it kind of, I want to say, just ignited the panel. It carried over to the panel discussion. And then when you have great minds like Judge Alex Williams and Dr. Barbara Williams Skinner to add with Dr. Warnock, and having a moderator like Dr. Hagray as a part of that panel, gave voice to a lot of different areas. You had legal voice, you had voices from the church, you had theologians, you had scholars, just a great mixture of people from the African-American community that could speak to religious liberty in the Black church.
It was a really good atmosphere there in terms of the energy.
One of the other reasons I wanted to do this, not only at Howard, but have this panel and discuss, you know, religious liberty in Black churches, because the Black church has a history and a unique history of church-state relationship. Although we follow church-state separation, and we know that's good for both, the Black community has always had a special relationship. For many years, the African-American preacher was more than just a preacher in the community. The African-American preacher was also the person that was the most educated, the most knowledgeable, and had to know the pulse of the community.
They were
the leader in the community, and they also were the people that the community looked to for not only spiritual guidance, but especially during the civil rights era, the 1960s, the African-American pastor became the African-American politician in many ways. And it was good to be able to go back over some of that history, to be reminded of people like Gardner C. Taylor, people like Reverend Adam Claypool Powell, who actually were those ministers and also people that knew about the politics that were going on and were leaders in both communities. So the African-American community has a special place and something that other communities can learn from when it comes to dealing with social justice issues and also having a faith community, and how those two things intermingle, how close they should be. I think sometimes we just focus on Dr. King, and that's never a bad place to focus, but there were so many others that were instrumental in the fights in those eras. And that's one of the reasons that we also wanted to get Dr. Warnock, not just because he was the pastor at, he's the pastor at Ebenezer, but because he is a scholar and a pastor. That's something that is special for the community.
That was one of the big themes of the panel, was the black theology versus black scholarship and how those things relate to each other.
Right, and that was also the focus of Dr. Warnock's book on The Divided Mind of the Black Church, where his emphasis is on the black scholar and the black minister actually having dialogue with each other, making sure that, you know, black theology and liberation theology was not separated from our faith and not separated from our everyday lives, that there has to be a conversation from those who are in political power with those who are in the church and in the faith community. And once you lose that conversation, then you become divided, because we have people from our community in both, and those people usually are in the same church, but they don't talk about it, and they kind of separate those two things, like, oh, this is for the church and this is for this part of the community. And you know, the people that are seen as scholars sometimes are seen as not actually living in the world, just talking about the world. And the people that are the faith community sometimes are seen as, oh, well, they're not thinking through everything, they're just talking directly out of faith. And so you got to have both of those things. Those are both powerful, and Dr. Warnock kind of is a representation of that today.
Charles, this was a co-production, so to speak, with BJC and Howard University School of Divinity. Why is this time so special for Howard Div School?
One of the great things about the symposium is that it was held in conjunction with the 100th year convocation of the Divinity School. It was special to, you know, be around 100 years and be putting out the scholars and the theologians and the pastors from the Divinity School for so long, that to be able to come together with such a prestigious university on such a big event of their 100th year convocation was very special for us and for the Divinity School.
So without further ado, let's hear the Reverend Dr. Raphael Warnock speak about religious liberty and the black church.
Well, good morning. Good morning. I know I'm among Baptists this morning, so we understand call and response. I'm grateful to be here, and I am deeply, deeply honored by this invitation, and particularly happy to be among friends in a moment like this. For all of you, I am indeed grateful. I want to thank the Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty for setting me up in this way. As I look across this body, there are great minds in this room. And I thought that Brent Walker was my friend, but I'm grateful to be here. Thank you so much for your introduction. So many friends here. And Dr. Alton Pollard, Dean here at the Howard Divinity School, and I taught a class together at Emory University's Candler School of Theology. I had just finished my PhD, had arrived in Atlanta, and had been in school nonstop from the age of 4 to 35. And I told him I wasn't stepping foot in anybody's classroom to learn or to teach for a little while. Give me one semester. And he leaned on me, and sure enough, that very same semester, right after I graduated, we were teaching together at Candlest. Good to see you, brother. I'm grateful to Cheryl Sanders, a friend and colleague, Dr. T. Body, who works with our denomination, Timothy Body. I saw Howard John Wesley here earlier. There he is. There's a preacher in the house, my good friend and brother, Dr. Kenyatta Gilbert, who has been kind enough to include one of my sermons in one of his great texts. You see, I'm stalling until they get this water here. Thank you so much. Gay Byron and I attended Union together. I don't know that I see her this morning, but tell her I said hello, and it's good to be here at Howard. Thomas Bowen and I attended Morehouse College together, although he's much older than I am. Where is Brandon Harris? Brandon Harris, I'm proud of this young brother. He graduated from Candler this past May. He is a joint member, we'll both claim him, Howard, of Ebenezer Baptist Church. He is the new dean, Protestant chaplain at Georgetown University. We just ordained him at Ebenezer. Stand up, Reverend Brandon Harris. Reverend Dr. Jeffrey Hagray is also a member of the Ebenezer Baptist Church, and we're grateful for the work that he does with the American Baptist Home Missions Society. Dr. Barbara Williams Skinner and I have worked together on many, many occasions. She is a powerhouse in and of herself, and whenever I want to bump into her, I just hang out somewhere near the White House because she's sure to be there. Well, actually, we will need you now more than ever. And I don't know if Dean Trulier remembers or not, but when I was a student at Union Seminary and an associate pastor at Abyssinian Baptist Church in Harlem, he was kind enough to come and teach in a Bible study that I used to head up. And on race matters, that's right. One summer, we spent the summer of 93 reading the Bible and Cornel West's Race Matters together. And it's really good to see you here again. Grateful to all of you. I think that's some of the folks, but brothers and sisters, fellow citizens of the Commonwealth of Faith, if I didn't call you by name, you know how we do in the Black church. I'm grateful that you're here. Please charge it to my head and not to my heart. I want to talk this morning about religious liberty and the prophetic vocation of the Black church. Will you bow with me in prayer? God, how we need you in a moment like this. We come to the work of prophetic vocation with both head and heart. So open our eyes that we might see, quiet our spirits that we might hear, and be glorified in us. Use us now as instruments in the building of your kingdom, imbued with love and justice. We ask this prayer in the name of the one who loves us into freedom and frees us into loving. Amen. Religious liberty is one of the hallmarks and part of the bedrock of American democracy, enshrined in the very first amendment of our Constitution, is the important prohibition of government from the establishment of religion and the equally important protection of the free exercise of religion and religious practice. Succinctly put, in America, our Constitution guarantees us freedom of, and if we desire, freedom from, religion. Although the phrase is not in the Constitution, this basic idea is often summarized as the separation of church and state, a cherished ideal to which the Baptist Joint Committee has been dedicated since 1936. Separation of church and state. How that actually works itself out as a matter of practice has, of course, always been contested terrain in the legislature, in the courts, and in the public square. But the larger point is that at stake in the separation of church and state is this basic idea we call freedom. In America, so we are told, we have freedom. Yet, religious freedom, like all other freedoms, has always been, for African Americans, complicated at best. After all, what is freedom for a person designated by the Constitutional Convention of 1787 as three-fifths of a human being? And while the three-fifths compromise itself may have receded to history, its legacy lives on in the myriad ways in which the ontological significance of black lives and black humanity is routinely compromised in our politics and in our culture, putatively for the sake of some larger good. The freedom provided by the separation of church and state has been of limited good for those who have known the violent encroachment of each upon their liberty separately and in tandem in the struggle to apprehend and maintain their humanity. That is to say that the church and the state, and the church in cahoots with the state, have been a problem for black people in the pursuit of liberty, including religious liberty. In the effort to capture and describe the relationship between individual freedom and the freedom of others in a pluralistic society, the old maxim says, "My right to swing my fist ends where your nose begins." Historically, this has not been the case for black people. Consequently, they bring particular hermeneutical insights into this question of religious liberty, because for black people, the reverse has been true. Black people's freedom and interests end where white people's desire to extend their own interests begins. And in the maintenance of this basic doctrine, there has been no separation of church and state. Yet denied religious freedom, African Americans have long been among the most ardent proponents of religious freedom. And we have used our religious freedom as a primary weapon and sophisticated subterfuge in the sometimes underground effort to secure other freedoms. There was a concern among the slaveholding class that the extension of even a severely circumscribed form of religious liberty might create a problem for the slaveocracy. If you catechized and Christianized the slave, and the slave was able to choose Christian faith for herself, you might actually have to do the unthinkable and emancipate her. So there was initially considerable resistance from planters to introducing slaves to Christian faith for fear of what it might suggest about their own worth and status in the divine economy. Religious freedom might lead to political freedom, was the fear. Likewise, the high egalitarian principles of the American Revolution and the glaring hypocrisy of fighting the British for freedom from tyranny while subjecting black people to chattel slavery was not lost on many in the colonies, black and white. With the implications of a revivalistic piety and revolutionary politics, each being dangerous and potentially subversive in its own right, It is not difficult to see how both freedoms held together, each informing the other, provide a recipe for abolition and slave rebellions. Therefore, the task of a so-called Christian slaveholding society became the construction and maintenance of a distorted theology or ideology that kept internal freedom and external freedom wholly separate, the separation of bodies and souls, while also holding at bay the revolutionary implications of each for a people in bondage. In this sense, Black people were victimized by a particular kind of construal of the separation of church and state in service to the larger project of white supremacy. In reality, the church and the state were joined at the hip, with each doing its work in denying Black people their basic human freedom. To this, they were in full agreement. This is why the lower house of Maryland asked the upper house in 1664, quote, to draw up an act obliging Negroes to serve durante vita for the prevention of the damage masters of such slaves must sustain by such slaves pretending to be christened, and so plead the law of England. Similarly, that's civic law. But this extends to canon law. Similarly, the Bishop of London opined, and so far is Christianity from discharging men from the duties of the station and condition in which it found them, that it lays them under stronger obligations to perform those duties not only from the fear of men, but from a sense of duty to God and the belief and expectation of a future account. It is against the oxymoronic backdrop and legacy of a Christian slaveocracy that Black people have had to fight for their liberty and their religious liberty, and have leveraged each in the pursuit and maintenance of the other. While others celebrated their liberty, African Americans have had to fight for their liberation. One preacher has said that when Patrick Henry said, give me liberty or give me death, one wonders what he would have said had his slave answered, me too. But it is the me too-ness of African-American Christian faith that brings to this question of the relationship between church and state liberty and religious liberty its own peculiar set of questions. In my text, The Divided Mind of the Black Church, Theology, Piety, and Public Witness, Amazon.com, $29.95. I talk about this continuing project of pursuing freedom. And I argue that it has happened in three distinctive moments, each of which is connected to the other. Five moments, but I lift up three for the purposes of our conversation this morning. The first is the formation of a liberationist faith. Black people did not buy this idea that in God's economy there was this great divide between the body and the soul. They saw the faith differently. And they did a miraculous thing. They received unto themselves a version of the faith radically different from the one passed on to them. Albert J. Raboteau says that the difference between the slave and the slave master's religion was wide and deep. Howard Thurman said, by some amazing but vastly creative spirituality, the slave undertook the redemption of a religion that the master had profaned in his midst. In other words, Black people weren't simply converted to Christianity. They converted Christian faith itself and transformed it into a liberating faith. Dwight Hopkins calls it the co-constitution of the black self. That is the first moment in black people's response to the question of the relationship between religious liberty and liberty, the formation of a liberationist faith. Because the black church, in a real sense, was born fighting for freedom. And I might say parenthetically that to the degree that it marginalizes the fight for freedom, it sells its own birthright and relinquishes its raison d'etre. Lucretia Alexander, a slave, said that when the preacher would come, that the master had sent, he'd preach the same sermon every Sunday. Don't steal your master's chickens. Don't steal your master's hogs. Do whatsoever your master says every Sunday. She said later at night, we would have a real meeting with some real preaching. She, of course, references the invisible institution, that first moment, the formation of a liberationist faith, which leads to the second moment, the founding of a liberationist church, the independent black church movement, pioneers of the African Methodist Episcopal Church. Described their project in this way in 1817. They say, we have deemed it expedient to have a form of discipline whereby we may guide our people in the fear of God, in the unity of the spirit, and in the bonds of peace, and preserve us from that spiritual despotism which we have so recently experienced, remembering that we are not to lord it over God's heritage as greedy dogs that can never have enough, but with long suffering and bowels of compassion to bear each other's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. So that is to say that in its piety and through its politics, it is with the mission of liberation that the black church was born. Its expression of religious freedom and independent institutional witness provided the foundation upon which it would struggle for political freedom. There is no Martin Luther King Jr. without Richard Allen. The effort of the latter came to full flower during the Civil Rights Movement and the ministry of Martin Luther King Jr., which is the third moment, the fomenting of a church-led liberationist movement. No single factor has contributed more to the rising political consciousness of the black church and the search for the radical side of its mission than the ministry of Martin Luther King Jr. To be sure, his ministry stands within and not apart from the long saga of black struggle and the cultural history of the black church. As I lift up this moment, defined by the ministry of Martin Luther King Jr. and others who worked with him in the civil rights movement, I do not want to separate him from the long saga of black struggle in our continuing project for liberty. Even within the history of Ebenezer Baptist Church itself, you see this clearly. We know that Dr. King fought for voting rights in 1965. Not enough of us know that his father, Martin Luther King Sr., led a voting rights campaign in Atlanta, the heart of the Confederacy, in 1935, 30 years earlier, when people were lynched for doing far less. His maternal grandfather, A.D. Williams, was an activist in his own right, who pushed through a bond referendum through which emerged the first high school for black children in Atlanta. It wasn't until the early part of the 20th century that black children in Atlanta had a public school to attend. Martin Luther King Jr. attended the public high school that existed only because of the activism of his maternal grandfather in the pursuit of liberty. But the church, the black church, the anti-slavery church, brings its own set of questions to the historic debate, particularly among Protestants, about religious liberty and the relationship between church and state. I think that distinction comes alive and is clearer in the public ministry of Martin Luther King Jr. more than anywhere else. This is why it is ironic that as King retells late in his career the story of his dramatic kitchen encounter in 1967, that sermon and that moment he'd like to recount that really changed his life, where he was threatened with death, when they told him, "You better get out of town or we're going to blow up your house." And he talks about how in that moment, Dr. Skinner, it occurred to him that the stuff he studied in seminary was good, but not good enough. Not when you're facing death. That Nietzsche was not going to get him, Nietzsche nor Niebuhr were going to get him through that moment. That he had to connect with the faith of his grandfather and his father and his mother, that God that they used to talk about. But as he recalls that moment with the rhetorical genius that is Dr. King's, he says that something stood up inside of him, remember? And he said, something said to him, "Martin Luther, stand up for justice, stand up for righteousness." Well, as he invokes with thunderous oratory his historic 16th century namesake, Martin Luther, and he does it with the rhetorical and narrative embellishments not unusual for black preachers, it is to the man whose name was Martin Luther, a 20th century reformer who was both historically conscious and self-aware, that the Spirit directs his urgings. Indeed, Luther was among those whom King had celebrated as, quote, creative extremists in the letter from Birmingham jail, his brilliant apologia for the movement and powerful response to 8 white clergymen critical of his actions and the ways in which he was using his platform in the church to challenge government. In the letter, King had declared with Luther, "Here I stand, I cannot do otherwise, so help me God." And in the sermon before a black congregation, Martin Luther is urged to stand up. In this way, King summons in defense of his movement the heroic genius of the Protestant reformer and what he invariably saw as a basic understanding of the gospel, irrespective of the ethical contradictions of race shared by both blacks and whites alike. To be sure, Martin Luther, like Martin Luther King Jr., was an extremist. For in Luther's context, the revolting peasants had sensed the radical implications of his version of the gospel. They heard Martin Luther and they were inspired. It was a new gospel that dared to circumvent the sacramental requirements and excesses of those in power, insisting upon justification by faith, and in a real sense, the freedom of the conscience that we Baptists like to emphasize. The Lutheran assault upon clerical and ecclesiastical authority, as well as the social and political import of Luther's arguments regarding the freedom of the Christian, captured the imagination of those struggling at the bottom rung of a feudalistic society. As they stated their demands in the 12 articles, they used not only scripture, but attached to their demands names from both of the major counts within the Reformation. At the top of the list were Melanchthon and Luther. Inspired by Luther's radical stance vis-a-vis the powers, they asked him to offer his response to the 12 articles, offering that they would withdraw from any demand that proved to be inconsistent with scripture. The preface to the 12 articles appealed to the biblical story of the Exodus, a prominent theme in black faith and in the public ministry of Martin King, as a theological basis for their struggle against tyranny and abuse. Moreover, informed by Luther's two kingdoms doctrine, which in some ways informs the American framework of the separation of church and state, They proffered a plan of redemption, as it were, that would combine dimensions of both what Luther called the kingdom on the right and the kingdom on the left. Not Democrat and Republican, but the heavenly kingdom and the earthly kingdom. Agreeing that many of the demands made by the peasants were in fact reasonable and just, Luther repudiated the practices of the princes and the lords whom he regarded as, quote, wild and dictatorial tyrants. Yet, he felt bound by scripture to insist that insurrection against temporal authority, the left kingdom, insofar as that authority did not traverse its civic boundaries, interfering with spiritual authority, the right kingdom, was indeed insurrection against the God who was Lord over both. In this way, he argued on the basis of his two kingdoms doctrine that the social and economic concerns pressed by the peasants in the name of divine law and the memory of the Exodus were carnal and misguided. Government is free, indeed ordained by God, to define liberty, as long as it does not encroach upon religious liberty. He would later deepen his resistance to the peasants, actually encouraging their massacre against the robbing and murdering hordes of peasants, was the essay. He argues there that baptism does not make men free in body and property, but in soul, religious liberty. Over against the peasants, who not unlike black slaves within the North American context, appealed to the Exodus motif as the basis for a freedom known within history, Luther opines that they were, quote, making freedom a completely physical matter. He argues a worldly kingdom cannot exist without an inequality of persons, some being free, some imprisoned, some lords, some subjects. The left kingdom was a part of the divine economy, currently construed. Such is an understanding of the work of the church as salvation's instrument that stands in stark and marked contrast to the theological assumptions behind the civil rights movement and the work of Martin Luther King Jr., although he lifts the name Martin Luther. For King's ministry emerges from the experience of a black church shaped in the cauldron of American chattel slavery, and it represents a radical trajectory of unapologetic political resistance to racism that white versions of the gospel in their evangelical, liberal, and neo-orthodox manifestations have been hard-pressed to support or even understand. We saw this clearly in the spring of 2008. Things have come full circle now. Perhaps we can talk about it. Millions of Americans, indeed people around the globe, were exposed to a 30-second clip of a fiery black pastor preaching to his own congregation one Palm Sunday morning 5 years earlier. Extracted from its theological and rhetorical context and looped to the point of ad nauseum on MSNBC, ABC, CNN, Fox News, was the most provocative phrase, "Goddamn America." One might safely say we have heard worse since. The black church, so central to black life, yet barely understood by mainstream America, was thrust to the center of the national dialogue. But the clip drew attention because he, the Reverend Jeremiah Wright of the Trinity United Church of Christ, happened to be the pastor of Barack Obama, then the nation's only, think about that, the nation's only black senator then. engaged in a formidable contest to become the first black president. The burning question within mainstream America was, what kind of church was this? What was the meaning of this kind of hate-filled preaching? Furthermore, what was the impact of this kind of preaching and this activist black church upon the worldview and politics of this man who would be president? It was lost in the fog of political war, but ironically, that very morning, Jeremiah Wright, in the best of the black preaching tradition, was talking about and preaching a sermon on the relationship between church and state, titled "Confusing God and Government." The sermon presented the critical reflections of a serious and thoughtful theologue on this fundamental question with which Augustine wrestled in the City of God, Martin Luther in temporal authority, to what extent it should be obeyed, Dietrich Bonhoeffer as he discusses state and church in ethics, and Martin Luther King Jr. in his letter from a Birmingham jail. Preaching the Lucan narrative, chapter 19, verses 37 through 44, if any of you are looking for a text for Sunday, in which Jesus weeps over the city of Jerusalem, Wright told his congregation that Palm Sunday of 2003 that the church was inept in its response to the Iraq War and to poverty and racism at home and abroad because, quote, we confuse God and government. In the best tradition of the Christian church and Christian theology, he counseled against this dangerous yet pervasive heresy. Like many preachers, he laid out a basic three-point sermonic outline. Etched against the backdrop of the Iraq War and an immoral war of choice, he argued that people of faith should not confuse governments, even the American government, with God, because one, governments lie. Two, he said, governments change. And three, governments fail. In the sermon, Wright argued that the United States of America, not unlike ancient Rome and other governments, will have to answer for its treatment of the most marginalized members of the human family. Contrary to the platitudinous pronouncements of politicians, America's moral and spiritual failure to seriously address itself to what Martin King called the triplet evils of racism, poverty, and war could not be answered or assuaged by simply saying or singing "God Bless America," like his ancient Hebrew namesake. And the other Old Testament prophets, Jeremiah Wright told his congregation that Palm Sunday, 5 years prior to Obama's 2008 candidacy, that in God's moral universe, public policies and foreign policies that crush the poor are not without moral consequences. That is what he meant when, after listing a litany of wrongs, including the mistreatment of Native Americans, Japanese Americans, and African Americans, he cautioned that while our songs and political pronouncements may say "God bless America," our actions may well say "God damn America." Well, 8 years after Obama's rise and Wright's exile as persona non grata in the minds of those who do not know him or his ministry, the provocative speech of the prophet Jeremiah, who preached that Sunday years ago about confusing God and government, haunts and hangs over our current condition as his former church member in this very moment, as I stand, welcomes today to the White House as his successor. A man who rose to political prominence by fanning the flames and funky stench of our ugly racial past, by arguing that this black man, no matter how accomplished, brilliant, or dignified, could not be a legitimate American president, and that his black family, descended of slaves, had no right to be there in the first place. Today, President Obama will welcome to the White House a president-elect who ran as a fascist, racist, sexist, xenophobe, who would expand the law and order mechanisms of the incarceration capital of the world. As we consider a Trump presidency and a Justice Department headed by the likes of Rudolph Giuliani, who was mayor when I lived in New York and got arrested my first time responding to the murder of an African immigrant who was shot by the police dozens of times while reaching for his wallet in front of his own home. We should remember that the United States is already unrivaled in the sheer size and magnitude of its prison population. We're housing about a quarter of the world's prisoners, although Americans only account for about 5% of the world's population. For many years now, prison construction and maintenance, a major economic engine for many small towns and the rural communities that rose up to elect Donald Trump, has had little or nothing to do with actual crime rates. In all of the large American cities, half of the young black men are caught up somewhere in the matrix and control of the criminal justice system, or hampered in their social mobility or civic participation by the social stigma of a criminal record. Most of them are charged with nonviolent drug-related offenses and are casualties in America's so-called war on drugs. Ironically, having circulated through the criminal justice system and stigmatized as a convicted felon, they come out only to be confronted with all of the legalized barriers against which Martin Luther King Jr. and those who battled the old Jim Crow fought, including discrimination in housing, employment, voting, and some professional licenses, public benefits, and student loans. Legally barred from the doors of entry to citizenship, symbolized in the right to vote, and denied access to ladders of opportunity and social upward mobility, those who have served time in America's prisons or who plead guilty in exchange for little or no actual prison time are often condemned to eternal social damnation. Moreover, Mr. Trump argued, among other things, that he would institute a religious test to our immigration policy, and that Muslims should be banned from entering the country. We would do well in this moment to remember the words of Martin Niemöller, who said that when they came for the socialists, I did not speak up because I was not a socialist. When they came for the trade unionists, I did not speak up because I was not a trade unionist. When they came for the Jews, in our context of Muslims, I did not speak up because I am not a Muslim. And then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak. Moreover, the vice president-elect, Mike Pence, has been the poster child for governors and state legislatures who would restrict the freedoms of sexual minorities and deny them protection from discrimination in the name of preserving a religious freedom already protected by the Constitution and established law. Liberty and religious liberty are in peril. Could it be that America's anti-slavery church, the black church born fighting for freedom, religious freedom, and political freedom, is uniquely shaped and situated both to perceive the threat and to lead in the important work of dismantling it? Will the black church, which Manning Marable rightly characterized as a politically ambiguous institution, yet possesses what Gayrod Wilmore, who is here, rightly characterized as a cohesive thread of radicalism, live up to the best of its prophetic vocation? Or will it give in to the seduction that has garnered from Mr. Trump, an admitted sexual predator, the support of 81% of white evangelicals and 60% of white Catholics? Perhaps more than anything else we have seen in modern times, the rise of Trump and Trumpism on the shoulders of Christians brings into sharp focus the moral bankruptcy of the American church. I have a sneaky suspicion that increasing numbers of millennials, a generation that has little tolerance for hypocrisy, will be exercising their religious liberty to studiously avoid the church. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., famed pastor of the church I am privileged to serve, once said that the ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands in times of comfort and convenience. I would extend that to say that the ultimate measure of an institution is where it stands in times of challenge and controversy. In the quest for freedom and justice, and at a time when many would confuse God and government, Dr. King said that the time comes when silence is betrayal. I submit that for the black church, a church born fighting for liberty and religious liberty, indeed for all of us, regardless of race or religion, that time is now.
That was the Reverend Dr. Raphael Warnock delivering his lecture as part of Religious Liberty and the Black Church, a BJC symposium. For more on the event, including videos and coverage from Report from the Capitol, visit bjconline.org/Howard Symposium. And thank you for listening to the Baptist Joint Committee podcast. For more podcasts, visit our podcast page at bjconline.org/podcasts or subscribe to our iTunes channel.